Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yes. My pleasure to be with you. We have Kirk here and James. Good evening, guys.
Good evening. How's it going?
Good. I understand that after we spent a considerable time discussing the fact that there's 92 million Americans that are legally being prescribed opiate-based painkillers. That does not include all other forms of painkillers, nor does it include heroin and fentanyl, nor does it include any of the mind-altering drugs and anxiety and antidepressant drugs that are being prescribed. That 60 Minutes did a show on it, and the 60 Minutes take on it was different than mine. Mine was, if you've got 92 million of your countrymen and maybe twice that, when you look at illicit drugs, drinking to excess, and the mind-altering drugs, that the problem isn't the supply. The problem is the hopeless mindset of the user, the lack of judgment among the users. But 60 Minutes, according to 60 Minutes, the problem is that the drug companies are greedy and that politicians are scheming, scheming, and just the bad news bears. Isn't that basically the 60 Minute story?
That's pretty much it. And they stopped the prosecution of the distributors who are the kind of go-between the manufacturers and the doctors and the pain clinics.
I mean, there was a bit of legislation, as I understand it, that precluded something that was not going very well in the first place. The government had set up a requirement for the manufacturers of these mind-altering and pain-killing drugs that people get hooked on to self-police, to reveal if there is an abnormally high amount of drugs being sent to a small pharmacy in a small urban area where they had a high propensity to order the highest dosages, which would indicate that it's being set up as for illicit use.
Sure.
And they had not been very successful in prosecuting that. But a politician, and politicians do things for bribes. I guess we found out that Hillary Clinton this week did, in fact, receive $150 million for giving the Russians access to America's uranium reserves. Politicians do a lot of things for bribes, and there was a politician that 60 Minutes singled out who did away with that legislation signed by Obama that essentially gave the drug companies carte blanche to drug as many people as wanted to be drugged.
Mm-hmm.
Is that basically the story?
Yeah. Yeah, his payoff was, of course. course, he became the drug czar.
Yeah, he became, he was nominated as the drug czar. That's just perfect.
It's just like
the CIA and the FBI prosecuting drug distributors when they, in fact, are the largest drug distributor. America. You know, the largest single concentration of prescription drugs in terms of the of who receives them and why they are given. You know what the largest culprit is by far?
Military.
And it'd be the U.S. military with their the drugs they've been given out for post traumatic stress syndrome. 650,000 Americans. Pretty staggering.
Wow.
I just want to reemphasize this point, and it seems like all of America, in terms of the media, has lost its collective mind, incapable of thinking. You know, they want to have a conniption fit over the Russians for influencing our elections, when all they can find the Russians did was buy ads on Facebook that directed people to fake news stories. So if you can throw an election by presenting fake news in social media, the problem isn't the ad. The problem isn't the fake news. The problem isn't the institution buying the fake news. It's that your population is too stupid to vote. They're idiots. And if you have manufactured that many idiots, your educational system is an absolute disgrace and counterproductive. That's the problem. The same thing is true with with having 92 or 93 million people being prescribed opiate pain killers. It's the problem is with the end user. They to take these kind of drugs, you're crazy. Particularly since, you know, in terms of painkillers, there are so many better options. You know, I occasionally get, you know, I'm an older guy, so if I'm working outside on an even services carrying loads, I'm likely to strain the ligaments in my knees, and they get inflamed, and you get, you know, the thing that's called bursitis, and it is really painful. I mean, there are times where you stand up and you just want to scream. I mean, it's really painful. And, you know, there's lots of ways to deal with it. But the drugs is about the worst of those options. The, you know, the best option is exercise, particular types of exercise, discipline to it, losing weight, and physical therapy.
Right.
Why isn't the people...
The painkillers do not do anything to get rid of pain. They just deaden the brain sensors that interpret pain. It doesn't get rid of the pain. It doesn't heal at all. Now, there are uses for it. You know, if you're having surgery, a certain level of painkillers are necessary.
Well, I've had surgery, and I'll tell you, the only kind of painkillers that I think are necessary is you need to be put out during the surgery.
Yeah, anesthesia.
But once you wake up, unless it's cancer surgery and they've just torn you to ribbons, you're really better off without the pain medication. Even Tylenol, so you're better off without it. It's addictive. Unless you have big time. There was a program last night on, I think it was PBS, on the air marshal for Hitler, Göring. And he was badly injured when he was a young man, and they prescribed him morphine. And he became a morphine addict. Never was able to shake it. He was a drug addict all of the rest of his life. It's just, there's some things you just can't do. They're addictive. Don't do it, you know, over the short term. And you know, sometimes you just got to deal with pain. Not the end of the world. Kirk, you told me that they found the guy that set those horrible fires where 41 people at least died and billions of dollars of damage were was done, mm-hmm. whole communities wiped out. What was his name?
Yeah, they arrested him. Uh-huh. His name is Jesus Gonzalez.
Okay, so Jesus has returned, and he's burned down Northern California. Is that the gist of the story?
Yeah.
Well, certainly Jesus is here.
I'm living in a sanctuary.
Yeah, Jesus is here in Northern California. I thought I'd share with you a passage that I've translated the last couple of days. The last couple of days I've actually been working in the Day of Midian. Who would have thought I would ever be telling the story of the Day of Midian? But it was among the most interesting stories I have ever had the pleasure of translating. We'll get into it one day. It's in the 17th chapter of Observations. But this is the ninth chapter of Yashaya. Now, everyone thinks the last chapter of Yashaya, the child is born, a son is given.
Mm-hmm.
And so they think, well, it's talking about Jesus. No, it isn't. Let me share with you a little, we'll return to where we were previously. It says, nevertheless. Now, if the first word of the first sentence in a chapter is nevertheless, you didn't start your chapter in the right place. Just as a hint there, you did not start your chapter in the right place if the first word is nevertheless. And that was my first point as I was writing this chapter, is that 9-1 and the message of chapter 8 is one continuous story. Anyway, nevertheless, there will be no sadness or gloomy darkness for those who were subjugated and oppressed. This, for her, is in contrast to the previous time, when he receded from the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. You know what the land of Zebulun and Naphtali are? What those represent?
Yeah, those are the two tribes.
Two of the tribes. They happen to be northernmost tribes. One of them is the kind of the doorway of where warring Gentile nations have always entered Israel. That would be the Naphtali, and the Zebulun is a tiny little landlocked tribe that's right at the heart, between the mountains and the sea. That warring armies, when they would invade Israel, that's where they would come through. So anyway, those were the two tribes that he mentioned. So God began just by, nevertheless, the sadness or gloomy darkness for those who were subjugated and oppressed. This, for her, is in contrast to the previous time when he withdrew from the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. And then at a later time following that, he will severely and harshly deal with the stubborn and irrational, troublesome nature and pretentious, vehemently oppressive nature of the way of the sea. Now, that would be, of course,
Gentiles,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes on to say, on the opposing side of the Yarden, so outside of Israel, serving as an open doorway and pivot point for the socio-political realm of the Gentile nations. Now, that's fairly interesting statement, because if that's 9-1, we aren't talking about 2,000 years ago, are we?
No.
Because Yahweh has not harshly dealt with the irrational, troublesome, pretentious, vehemently oppressive nature of those on the opposing sides of the Yarden, the socio-political realm of the Gentile nations. But he's going to. By the way, that also says I'm going to hold them accountable. And since the Christian church is a Gentile organization.
Hostile organization.
Yeah, I'd be really concerned if I were them. The family of related people who have walked in the darkness and in error will see for a finite time an appearance of a great and expansive light. Those who have lived in the realm of foreboding darkness and in the shadow of death, a light will shine on them. Now, I want to ask you guys, 2,000 years ago, starting around 2 BCE and running through 33 CE, did Yosha appear as light?
That is worse, did he?
No.
Light? No.
No, yeah, the answer is absolutely not. You know, there's a quick story. It's only attested in one of the books that he went to the Mount of Transfiguration and briefly was transfigured there. I don't know if the story is credible or not, but if that happened, three people saw it.
Yeah, it wasn't ratcheted up, no.
Yeah, this absolutely is not speaking of that.
No.
So he did not come as light, did he?
No.
Came, you know, in spirit and flesh and bone, but not as light. So we're not talking about what happened in 2,000 years ago. So they did not see an appearance of a great and expansive light. However, how was he returning?
Yom Kippurim. Same way.
Yeah, exactly. So we're not talking about what was. We're talking about what will be once again. The family of related people, Am, so we're talking about Israel, who have walked in the darkness and error, will see for a finite period of time the great and expansive light. You have improved and prolonged the lives of a number of those from different races and places, increasingly nurturing their joy. Cheerfully, they rejoice in your presence before your appearance, similar to the jubilation during the ingathering of a harvest, just as they will be ecstatic when they share the spoil, apportioning the property and possessions they have gained. All right. I would ask you, when Yosha appeared 2,000 years ago, were there any Goyim who were prolonged, enriched, nurtured, joyful, witnessing a harvest, or sharing in a spoil?
No.
No, we've got to go forward now, 2,000 years from that, about 16 years on our time clock. We've got to go forward to 2033, to Yom Kippurim, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to find, and I'm not sure we're going to find any outside of our company, but yeah, well, we'll find some people from different races and places, some boy, whose lives he has improved and prolonged, whose lives are now more joyous. And cheerfully, they're going to rejoice in Yahweh's presence, similar to the jubilation of the ingathering during the harvest. Because at this time, we will be anywhere from 6 to 7 years away from our joy of during the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be ecstatic because... And, you know, I was originally kind of a little concerned that the word for here is spoil. But that's exactly what's happening. You know, when you have a spoil of war, what happens is that you defeat somebody and you take what they have. Right?
Yeah. Spoil of war. Take the souls back.
Yeah. Well, what we're going to find is what Yahweh was talking about here, is that he's going to obliterate every military and going to turn the people, just going to incinerate them with his light. And we are going to inherit the world that they once controlled.
Yep.
And so we are getting a spoil. And the spoil we're getting happens to be the earth reconfigured into the conditions found during the Garden of Eden. And it's going to be fun. So that's what he's talking about here. And that's only going to occur in the future. For indeed, you've cast away the yoke of his economic burden from his back, along with the means to extend the reach and influence of the ruling authorities wielding a staff, a scepter, or a spear. A staff would mean religious people, a scepter, political people, or a spear, those in the military, with regard to those who would strive to exploit him, exerting their influence over him, to control the masses and tax them, subjecting them to undue pressures to submit and comply. So he's getting, we're witnessing Yahweh removing economic control and influence, political, religious, military.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened thus far. It's going to happen. So similar to the day of Midian. How many of you really know what happened on the day of Midian and why? Do you know what happened on the day of Midian? The Midianites were pretty good dudes. You know, who did Moshe go off and meet with after he fled Egypt?
Well, yeah, that's the Midianites too.
Who gave him the sheep that he could tend to? Who gave him the daughter of the king? Who took them into their company? The Midian,
mm-hmm.
right? And where were the Midianites? Do you have any idea where they were located?
In Arabia? Near Arabia?
Yeah, right there in the foothills of Mount Horeb. Well, the Midianites didn't stay congenial. They became extraordinarily evil, and they hooked up, Kirk, with your favorite people.
The Amalekites.
They did. They did indeed. And and they also partnered with Babel. They call them the sons of the east. So the sons of the east is explained in the Bereshit as those that built Babel. And collectively, they were coming in to destroy Israel. They would come in, and as you should share the story, they came in like locusts, and they devoured everything. And they would come in right at the harvest and take everything that was valuable and destroy what they didn't want to carry out or eat. And then one day it came to pass that they decided, we've toyed with them enough. We've terrorized them enough. We'll just wipe them out. And they came in with this huge, massive army. And found this fellow Gideon. Gideon.
In a wine press.
You know what he was doing in a wine press?
He was making his last meal or something.
He was grinding grain in a wine press because he felt that if I'm doing this in a wine press, they won't find it. They won't confiscate it. And the conversations with Gideon are just priceless. Everybody that God finds. I guess there just really aren't a lot of good people to work with. But God decided, I'm going to work with this one guy. You alone. With you, I'm going to save Israel, he said. You alone. And the way that God works with Gideon is, it's one of the great stories that I have ever read, particularly in the details. And we'll get to that one day. But Yah was talking about, as was the day of Midian. So, the sixth chapter of Shaphat, Judges, just presents the preamble. This is what the Amalekites, and this is what the Midians and the Babylonians were doing. And they were essentially destroying Israel, making it a place that no one could live. And so they had to be driven out for Israel to survive. And the sixth chapter explains that and explains how God came upon Gideon and the whole story of Gideon's fleece. I mean, if you talk to a Christian about Gideon, all they're going to know about is the fleece and the test of the fleece. Dew on the fleece, no dew on the land. Dew on the land, no dew on the fleece. And the insights there are stunningly volume, and we'll talk about that in the future. But the day of Midian then follows, where you got this huge army encampment. Again, they're like locusts. Their camels can't even be counted, and they're armed to the teeth. And do you have any idea what how many people Yahweh decided he would take against the Midianites?
300.
Yeah, 300. And what's interesting, you know what he has a number of tests. Because it starts with 22,000 that volunteered and got there.
Yeah.
I can't work.
Weed it out. Weed them down.
Well, there is no way in the world that I'm going to deal with 22,000 people. That's way too many people. Now, that ought to scare the bejesus out of Christians. God said,
you don't want me,
does
it?
I'm not going to deal with 22,000 people. How is he going to deal with 3 billion? No way I'm going to deal with 22,000. Way too many people, he says. So he says, if anybody is the least bit fearful, go back to your place. Go back home. So the fear of God, test one. If you're fearing God, you don't know it.
You're out.
Go away, you're out. Okay, the second test. The second test is just my absolute, absolute favorite. There's a group of people that made it through the, that, by the way, the first text took it down to 10,000. And then there was a second test. In the second test, God just said,
top of water? And they're drinking water?
Yeah, that's the third test, actually, I think. The second test is, God just makes it real clear. Says, I want to tell you who I want and who I don't want. And if I say I don't want them, I don't. You are not to go forward with them. If I say I do want them, they're to be included. Is that clear? I want who I want, and I don't want to those who I don't want. Now that part was just riveting because, you know, we've came to this conclusion that no one comes to know God unless he introduces himself first. While it is technically possible, it is so difficult with societal indoctrination on, you know, the Torah being arcane, obsolete, mean-spirited, you know, from a wrathful God, being replaced, whatever it might be, that the likelihood somebody's going to go there and then take the time to translate it so they can understand what God said, it is so enormously remote that if God didn't intervene and introduce himself first, chances are no one would have known him. So what God is saying is, you know, it's my universe. It's my house. Don't you think I get to choose who I want to spend? Yeah, who I want in my home, who I want to be part of. I don't get to choose who I adopt. I mean, come on. Think it through, people. So this idea that we choose God is nonsense. God chooses who he wants to be with. Now, the fact that he chooses who he wants to be with doesn't preclude our free will at all, because what we do next, how we respond to him, is completely up to us. But the first choice is God's. He chooses. Man doesn't choose. Man, who's arrogant man to say, yeah, well, yeah, you can choose to be with God. No, you can't. Now, then the next test. Kirk, you just got a new puppy dog, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, you really like dogs?
Yeah, we love dogs. Puppies are a work in progress.
Yes. Yeah. So, those that God chose to accept did what? They lapped up water with their tongues like dogs.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, why do you think God said, these are the ones that I want? They lapped up water like a dog. Maybe it's to tell us that, you know, you can look at the character and the manner of a dog, and you can learn a lot. Loyal. Loving. They listen to what you have to say. They want to please you.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be part of the family. You want to protect the family. You want to spend all day with you, given the opportunity.
Well, I'd take another take on it is because they were looking up and observing while they were drinking.
Well,
their focus was.
Well, the ones that he rejected, which were, you know, 90-some-odd percent of those who he had already not sent home, those he rejected were bowing down, getting down on their knees.
Right.
If you're bowing down, God does not want you. That's an amazing story. So if you're bowing down, God does not want you. Yeah, it's really telling the whole story. So then, yeah, they go with 300. So you know what the weapons that they brought to bear against the Midianites and the assembled warriors down there? There were too numerous to count. But the 300 rep- representatives of Israel took his weapons?
They had two. They had a lantern.
They had two.
A knife, a short sword, or a knife.
No. In fact, the sword never appears in the story. Translated sword twice, but the sword never appears in the story. Yeah. No, they had two things. One on the right hand, one on the left hand. On the right hand, they had a shofar. The shofar. Now, I mean, I guess if you're really bad at playing the thing, you can kill somebody. At least to the point they'd want to die.
You heard it.
Like you hear it.
Okay,
but a shofar is a ram's horn trumpet. A trumpet made out of a ram's horn. They blew the trumpet. Okay, so that was weapon number one. They blew the trumpet at them. That was in the right hand. You know what their left hand?
I thought it was the left
hand. Equivalent of a tiki torch. They took some empty jars and they put some flax in them. They doused the flax with olive oil and they lit it on fire. Those were their weapons. They did not throw them like their Molotov cocktails and burn the camp down. In fact, they took their lanterns and they shattered them. And they took the trumpets and they blew them. And the Midianites and all of those gathered with them fled. And then Yahweh destroyed them. That's the story. And so what's the day of Midian? It's when people listen to God, even when it's an extremely small number of people listen to God and respond to what he is asking them to do, Yahweh not only protects them and protects their home and drives those who are evil and destructive away from their home, Yahweh obliterates those involved in the ministry.
Well, that was in chapter 16 too that we were reading this week. As if you trust God, you don't need weapons, you don't need anything.
Right. That's the story of the day of Midian. So this reads, so similar to the day of Midian, surely, since every boot worn by the trampling soldiers of marching armies is part of the commotion and clamor of battle, the staccato percussion of weapons, and the fearful response to it all, along with the clothing which is befouled by wallowing in blood, they shall come to exist as fuel, to be burned up in the fire of blazing light. And we'd always thought that the story in Zechariah where Yahweh turns him to ooze and Malachi. You know, when he comes back, he's so bright that everybody just vaporizes. That's not covered in the garment of light and the set apart spirit. But in fact, right here in Yeshayah 9:5, the statement immediately before the most quoted Old Testament prophecy, God is saying, when I return, I'm going to obliterate. My light is going to obliterate. It's going to incinerate all of the armies of the world. Now, that's going to happen on his return. But it's also a confirmation of what the return is going to be all about. It's we don't have God supporting our troops. We've got obliterating them. So I just thought that was fabulous. By the way, there is one other little insight in them. There's a ton of insights in it, but one of my favorites is when Gideon finally starting to listen to God, and he did his test. Do you know how God equipped him to be the one person who could save Israel?
No.
Now, you would never find it if you're reading an English translation, because it says that the Spirit came upon him. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says the Spirit adorned him. And the word for adorned means adorned him in a brilliant white garment. It's the thing we've been saying for years now. The set-apart Spirit prepares us by adorning us in her garment of light. It's right there in the middle of Shaphat in the judge's story of the day of Midian. So lots of interesting things. And then from there, then we have that famous passage, but what God is doing now, it's obvious since he's been talking about the end, is he's telescoping time, which is his perspective on time. To telescope time means you just bring all time together. I was going to tell you the whole story in a snapshot where there is no depth of field anymore. I'm going to telescope time, bringing it all together. He says, for indeed, a child is born. Now, the child is from Yalad. Child is Yaled, and born is Yalad. Same word, just the noun and verb born. He is conceived and brought forth through a pregnant woman. Boy, that's rare. That doesn't happen very often, has it? For indeed, a young boy, from infant to young man, is born. By the way, that would be lowercase child, lowercase he in talking about him. It's just a child was born. To us a son is given. Nathan is produced and provided, appointed and set in place, is bestowed. So, written, by the way, that was written in the Nephil Passus, the subject, the son, carries out the appointment as he becomes the gift, passively, in both for both, over a finite period of time. And the power to engage and endure, this is Misra. Misra is the means to empowerment and liberation. It means the ability to persist and perceive. You know what this word is from? It's from Sarah. Sarah means to, Sarah is the name that sits at the heart of Israel, Yisrael, and it is also the name of the mother of the covenant. It means to persist, persevere, endure, engage, contend. So if you look at every English translation, it says the government shall be on his shoulders. Well, there is nothing that is government-related about Sarah. And Miss Sarah can't mean government. So it's the power to engage and endure. She'll be upon his shoulder. She'll exist upon his shoulder. Now, Yahweh through Yosha accomplished that on Pesach. And his name shall be called out Wonderful Counselor. Did Yosha ever claim to be the Wonderful Counselor? No. Yahweh doesn't even say he's the Wonderful Counselor, except when he's listing the seven spirits of Yahweh. The Wonderful Counselor is the set-apart spirit. So now we have a reference to the Son on Pesach, and we have a reference to the set-apart spirit. Wonderful, amazing advice, if you will. And then Almighty God. Well, that doesn't apply to the set-apart spirit or the Son, Yosha, because this is the totality of God. Eternal Father. The Son was not the Father, obviously. Eternal Father. And then the last, it says the Prince, but Sar, which... And Sar's got a lot of definitions that in English come out Prince, but the fact is that Sar is the basis of Sarah. The means to empower reconciliation. You try to dig in, figure out what the words actually mean, and you try to understand why these references are made. And what you come up with is something so radically different than what you've been led to believe. So the Jesus that came to start the fires in Northern California ain't the right one.
No.
All right, let's return to Yeshaya 5. That's in the 14th chapter of Observations. And we're on page 47, but I want to just recap the statements immediately before where we are headed. It says, well, this is a warning regarding a disastrous and destructive situation which can ruin a person. So this is a cautionary tale to those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting. In a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futilely and vainly promoting worthless lies about pagan gods and idolatrous images using false and empty promises. As with the ties that bind on the harness of a cart of sin, the one among them says, without thinking and out of anxiety at the future, he should want to hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may see it. Oh, forget about God's timeline. I want it done on mine. And then let the counsel of the cross and painful advice of the Holy One of Israel approach and present itself, because we want to have it revealed and shown to us. Whoa, this is a warning to the one among those who call that which is evil, that which is wrong, contemptible, and malicious, good, correct, beneficial, and generous. Who call that which is good, evil. Who replaces that which is sweet for that which is bitter and anguishing, disagreeable and obstinate. And that which is obstinate for and pleasing and acceptable for poison, which embitters, for toxic mix of obstinate rebellion. He's talking here primarily about Paul and the legacy of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, this is a warning to the learned and scholarly, the crafty and cunning in their own eyes and from their own perspective, giving the impression and outward appearance of understanding, and to those making connections as a contrarian through their appearance and public persona. Whoa, this is a warning to the powerful and influential, to the politicians, the military heroes, as a result of becoming drunk by consuming wine, or today, doing all manner of drugs, becoming inebriated, and to individuals of nobility and wealth with regard to mingling and mixing together intoxicants, which impair judgment. Boy, has that ever happened in America.
Mm-hmm.
Who justify and acquit those who are wicked and evil as a quid pro quo to gain influence, thereby turning away and rejecting those who are upright and righteous, correct and vindicated from him. Boy, how many people do you think had to be bribed in one way or another for Harvey Weinstein to assault women for 40 years?
Mm.
For the Clintons to go on their campaign of robbing the American people. Now, the fifth and final stanza of Yahweh's song is why we opened this chapter early. It's still a song to his beloved, to Dod, and it contains another warning. It is spoken against everyone who is religious and also political, to Christians especially. Having come to cherish Paul's letters, they have rejected and come to despise Yahweh's Torah. But they're not alone. Muslims believe that their Quran has replaced the Torah. Religious Jews, deliberately, have substituted their Talmud for the Torah. And socialist secular humanists are at war with it, creating a social order that is the antithesis of what God intended through his Torah. The consequence of rejecting the Torah is to wither and rot away, according to God. Life is but a short affair from dust to dust. So why would anybody do so? Why avoid the word of God? Why would anyone treat his promises with contempt? Why belittle the Almighty? Or may I pose the question this way? Why do those who claimed to be preaching God's word despise what he had to say?
That's a $64,000 question.
Isn't it indeed? Therefore, then, just as a tongue of fire devours the chaff, and the scorching blaze withers the dry and combustible foliage, their roots, accordingly, become rotten with the stench of decay, and their blossoms are like the dust which is carried away, because they have rejected and come to despise the Torah of Yahweh. Of the vast array of spiritual messengers. The instructive word and promise of the set apart one of Yisrael, they spurn, have discarded, and treat with contempt. I mean, it's staggering that man would do this to God. And so God says, you know, it's your choice, but if you're going to reject and despise my Torah, if you're going to discard and treat with contempt my instructive words and promises, here's the consequence. You know, your survival is going to be akin to a scorching blaze that burns up the chaff, that burns up all of the foliage. Well, we saw that in Northern California. I mean, those communities, there is nothing left. Burnt to nothing but a sea of ash.
Yeah.
And when that happens, the roots die. We become rotten. And the blossoms are like the dust which is carried away. And the reason is they rejected the Torah. Well, there isn't a Christian on the planet that hasn't rejected the Torah. There's not a Muslim on the planet that hasn't rejected the Torah. There's not a secular humanist on the planet that hasn't rejected the Torah. And we can just go ahead and throw in, just because there's a billion of them, every Hindu has rejected the Torah.
Sure.
Well, that would leave you, of the 7 billion people on Earth, at about a billion of the 7 billion who aren't part of that list. But I would dare say that if you were to look at those who would fall outside of this list, who haven't come to reject the Torah, and who haven't come to reject and despise God's promises and His instructive words, you'd be down to a few hundred. I don't know if you'd find more than a few hundred. But if God is telling you specifically, this is the cause of you being utterly destroyed, and it's that you rejected my Torah, and you're lugging that around in your Christian babble, what is it? Where's the disconnect? Why aren't you saying, wait a minute, God just said that if you reject the Torah, then you're going to be incinerated. And we've got this New Testament where half of it is presented as a wholesale rejection of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Particularly when he's so clear that the litmus test for, are you with me or are you against me? Are you going to be destroyed and incinerated, your soul ceasing to exist? Or are you going to live? Is your attitude towards the Torah accepted or rejected? By the way, it's interesting, too. The fire is on this side of hell. And if we may use the Christian nomenclature for Sheol, the fire is on this side of it, not on the other side.
It can't be in Sheol.
No, it can't be in Sheol. But it is the thing that that serves to wipe out those that will cease to exist. It's the crucible. It's the fire refines. But it's on this side. Accordingly, therefore, the anger of Yahweh was aroused, and it's aroused with his people. And he stretched out and turned his hand upon them, and he struck them, hoping that they would regret what they have done. And the mountains were shaken, and so were the likeness of their corpses, which were unwanted and poised to be swept away in the midst of their streets and public places. In all of this, his animosity and displeasure, however, did not return. And so his hand is still outstretched. Now, that's really an interesting presentation. We don't very often think of God striking his children. But here he is. And the reason he's striking them is he's trying to awaken them from just continuing to perpetrate the worst possible behavior. They're rejecting him, and they're going to die. And he's saying, wake up. And it didn't do any good.
But even worse than that, they're going to perpetuate it to their children.
Yes.
I mean, he got nothing to lose by striking them. They're gone. All they can do is hang around long enough to really infect the rest of them. So it seems fair.
Yeah. Just stop it. But he says, now my hand is still outstretched. So why would his hand still be outstretched unless it was to lift them up, to show them a sign, to be there for them? You know, I tried to wake you up. It didn't work. But I'm not going anywhere. I made a promise to Abraham. I'm going to honor the promise. My hand is still outstretched. Grab hold of it if you want to be lifted up. So while he was frustrated on that day, what happened is that it doesn't do any good to be frustrated, and he ran out of people that he could communicate through. So for just a very long time, while he was still willing to lift up anybody who would willing to come to him, for the most part, he withdrew. And really, the hand of Yahweh was really all that was left. The hand of Yahweh would be Yahusha, if you will. So that brings us to the realization that, you know, quite honestly, we ought to feel sorry for God. We really do. We ought to feel sorry for God, especially after all He's done for His people. You know, if He had any other response to them, it would show that He didn't love them, that He no longer cared, that He had given up on them. But He didn't. Hand was still out. He still wanted to help them. So this is what follows is the reason we came to this passage. What is he talking about? It says, then he will lift up a standard, serving as a banner and signal. It's from Neck. A prominent sign or an insignia hosted high upon an upright pole for all to see, serving as a signal or ensign to convey important information which should be followed to bring people into the proper encampment. It's masculine singular. It's from Nakak and Naka. That which is anointed, set apart, prepared, designated, and authorized to serve by pouring out proof which can be tested. So then he will lift up a standard, serving as a banner and signal for the Gentile nations. So this is something that's not happening inside of Israel.
No.
This is not something that is going to initially be seen by Israel. Initially, this is going to be seen by Gentiles from far away. So, remote from Israel. This can't be Syria, can't be Israel, can't be Yehuda, can't be Egypt, can't be Babylon, can't be the Middle East, can't be Greece, can't be Rome. From far away.
Mm-hmm.
A great distance away. And oh, by the way, Men Rokok also means in the distant future. And he will attract attention non-verbally to it from the ends of the earth. He will attract attention non-verbally is from Sharak. He will reveal the signal by drawing attention. It's used to describe the piping, or describe piping that pierces the ear and penetrates the ears of a shepherd who's calling for sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to attract and draw attention to it from the ends, the far extremities of the earth. Well, that would be impossible until the last 15 or 20 years. And behold, in a very brief period of time, quickly and rapidly, voiced at the speed of light, call swiftly and speedily, nimbly and agilely, moving one place to another while lightly esteemed by many, using the sound of one's voice, calling out aloud, he will come. It will come, depending on how you want to deal with the pronoun. It or he will come, dealing either with the individual who has comprised this signal or the signal itself. Bo will arrive. That's Yeshaya 5:26.
What this is.
So, as we consider whether there is someone else living a great distance away from Israel at this time, who is engaged in exposing and condemning each of the three religions which have commingled the truth and lies in their attempt to usurp credibility derived from their incredulous association with Yahweh's Torah and prophets, who is, at the same time, devoted to sharing Yahweh's message as it's presented in the Torah as accurately and completely as possible, who is unwavering in their dissemination of that message worldwide on behalf of a people in many places of many races. Is anyone else considering, can be considered for the intent of Yahshua 5? Is there anyone else other than us as we're doing this?
I think we'd be able to find them.
I can't think of anything.
If they were.
You'd think that they would somehow be known. In fact, they would make themselves known to us because, you know, millions of people around the world Google access to these books and these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody else was doing the same thing, they'd say, you know, what a pleasure it is to find somebody that knows Yahweh's name, that speaks of the Mikre as the path to camp out with God, and understands the purpose of each of them, understands the terms and conditions of the covenant, understands that Torah means teaching, understands that Yahusha is nothing more or less than a diminished, set apart manifestation of Yahweh, that the Spirit is set apart from Yahweh, and that she has maternal characteristics. You know, you think that if somebody else
and just loves the Torah, period. I mean,
right.
they reach out.
Right, who at the same time, has destroyed Pauline Christianity, vocally and unequivocally. Who at the same time had realized that how important it is to learn Hebrew, if you want to understand who God is and what He's offering. Do you think that if there's anybody who was doing any one of those things that we wouldn't have heard from them?
It'd be almost impossible, wouldn't it, James?
Yeah. Well, I think we would have found them. Yeah, we do enough searching online.
Oh, yeah, because I search probably 20 things online every day as a result of these translations and commentary that I write. I'm doing it all the time. No, I don't come up with anything. Every time I put in anything that has to do with any of the insights that we find, the first 10 things that are listed are our books and shows. Yeah. So no.
It's what an honor.
Yeah, so, if you...
But what a shame you're looking at.
Yeah, at this particular chapter of Yahshua, the other thing that is essential that I don't think anyone else is doing around the world is we've come to recognize that the central figure, the most important person who's ever lived, is Dode.
Yeah.
That he is Yahweh's beloved son, that he is right, and that his psalms explain how we can join him and also be right with Yahweh, and how we can become beloved sons and daughters of Yahweh. This entire chapter is devoted to Yahweh's beloved, to Dode.
I think you put it best the other day when you said, we technically have nothing from Yahusha.
Nothing.
Not a single thing he ever said or wrote.
Nothing penned
right.
by him.
Nothing.
And we have volumes of Dode.
We have Dode we have Dode from sources beyond compare. I mean, we have Dode's whole life chronicled in Chronicles, and in the Samuel, and in Kings. We have all of Dode's insights and conversations with Yahweh chronicled in the Mizmor Psalms. We have Dode as the logical author of most of the Proverbs. And besides that, we've got everybody talking about Dode.
Mm-hmm.
Dode is all over Yahshua. In fact, in the sixth chapter, there's going to be another reference to Dode. It's going to establish the kingdom of Dode. When Yahweh returns, all the way to his return, he's going to establish the kingdom of Dode. And so...
Well, ironically, though, he's the greatest source for everything important about Yahusha.
Correct. Yeah, that's a really interesting...
Yeah.
Yeah. Dode and Yahusha are both called the branch. And realistically, there really is nothing, well, there's not nothing. There's surprisingly little that we can know about Yosha apart from Doe's writings, and Doe provides the best eyewitness account of what occurred. Now, while we're speaking of Yosha here, because of the importance of Dode, I had come to the conclusion, and it's now something that was underscored by a massive edit that Roy provided on, I think it's chapter 15, and I ended up rewriting a section tremendously, and then Jackie provided two citations from Yashayah, which proved the point. When Yosha was born, he was an ordinary kid. He was an ordinary human being, all the way up to the point where the Spirit of Yahweh descended upon him in the Jordan, and Yahweh said, "This is my son, who I am pleased." Prior to that, now the one thing that he had that was unique, and Roy was the one that came up with this idea, and I think he's right. When Gabrielle, if you will, met with Miriam, what I think he was carrying, first, I think she was pregnant and was carrying a child. But you know what, and the fact that he referred to himself as the Son of Man, it was Yosef that caused her to be pregnant. What he was carrying was Yahweh's soul. And so the soul of Yosha was Yahweh's. But Yosha did not become the diminished manifestation of Yahweh until the Spirit descended upon him. And he ceased to be that 3 years later upon the upright pole of the Passover. So the citations that we found and applied to it in Yashayah now make that that conclusion unequivocal. God wasn't born. God did not die. And for 30 of the 33 years that Yosha was here, he was not God. Now, those are some stunning implications with regard to that. But we'll let that sink in and we'll deal with it in a future chapter. But what I do want to emphasize is that this whole chapter began by speaking in metaphorical terms about Yahweh planting a vineyard on Zion and how religious and political and militant people destroyed that vineyard. And that the vineyard was attended by, of all people, his beloved, Dod, who planted it together with Dod. That while Moshe brought us the Torah, Dod explained it. He told us how to understand it, how to live it, how to apply it, how to observe it, how to benefit from it. It's all from Dod. And you put all that into context, because this the fifth chapter specifically condemns Paul. It specifically says that the Torah is the litmus test. Your perception of the Torah is going to determine whether or not you will be destroyed or live. At this point, there isn't anybody else doing this. And so the banner that Yahweh lifted up, that was lifted up very far away from Israel, at a very distant time, that has been mostly read and to benefit Gentiles, is Yadiyah, and an introduction to God, and observations for a time, and questioning Paul, and shattering myths, and Yadiyah radio, and the Torah Shabbat story that we collectively have created based upon translating Yahweh's word and have shared to people, whether it be on Facebook or on YouTube or on websites, on radio programs, you name it, around the world. And there's no other candidate. Now, I hope, because, by the way, I think this is very much like Yashaya 91. I think Yashaya 91 was written for me, and I think it was written for all of you. Anyone who engages doing what Yahweh wants done, Psalm 91 applies. So you can say it applies to you personally. I can say it applies to me personally. I think this applies to us. But that doesn't mean that it's exclusive to us.
No.
There may be, and hopefully there will be, others that come along that have come to the same realization that Yahweh can lift up their standard too. That would be a good thing. It wouldn't be a bad thing. It would be a wonderful thing. Right now there isn't. But we hope that will change. So, it's a really big, and some may say, verbose banner, all these books and these shows. But yet it's infinitesimally small when compared to the source from which it was derived. You know, all we are doing is waving what we have discovered up, hoping that those who are interested will go to the source and learn about Yahweh. Now, in the 15 years that we've been engaged in this mission, when compared to the 6,000 years that have transpired since Adam and Chawa were expelled from the Garden of Eden, especially compared to the 14 billion years since Yahweh began creating the universe, it's a fairly short time by any measure, our 15 years. And our task is finite. It will serve no purpose after Yahweh's return. And at that time, he will inscribe the Torah inside of us, rendering our feeble efforts of translating his Torah completely obsolete. Now, as I shared in the chapter devoted to the 91st Psalm, I made a deal with God, one whose terms are reflected in this prophecy. I was willing to do the research, compile the findings, and be available to share what I had learned, so long as Yahweh took responsibility for lifting up, distributing the message. I would inscribe his words on the banner, and he would lift it up for the world to see. Even the means of broadcasting the message to the world is consistent with what has been made available to us, the Internet. Without it, relatively few would have heard my voice, your voices, or have had access to these books or your sites. As for the speed in which these words are shared, they are indeed transmitted at the speed of light. From the moment a chapter or show is complete, it is made available for everyone around the world to see. Now, as we move to Yahweh's next prophetic statement, there is an important, albeit subtle, difference between the Great Isaiah Scroll and the Masoretic Text. The reference to not growing weary is masculine singular in the Qumran Scroll, the Great Isaiah Scroll, and stands alone. Further, AF, growing tired, is a verb rather than an adjective. But the biggest difference is that the Masoretic reads, "No one among them," suggesting that there are many banners being lifted up instead of one. That's the implication of the Masoretic. But according to Yashaya, there's only one. Based upon what follows, the banner which is lifted up for the world to see and the person assisting with it are shown as indistinguishable and inseparable, indicating that Yahweh is going to do as he has always done, convey his message through the most flawed of implements, a man. Each of the following references depict an individual who tirelessly engages without wavering, whose approach is so stimulating it can't be ignored, or so forceful it can't be ignored. I don't know what way you want to look at it, but it's hard to ignore.
Yes.
He is prepared for action and girded for battle, so much so that he has never been susceptible to attack. Nothing prevents him from going where he intends. And while that assessment is overly, obviously, overly hyping this individual's preparation and performance, keep in mind that the individual isn't acting alone. Yahweh is engaged. And so are his Shabbah of Malach to ensure that the implement is used in the most far-reaching, appropriate, and productive manner. In other words, this person is simply willing, passionate, wholly committed, steadfast, and energetic as a tool. I want to underscore one thing here. I've said it so many times that I want to make certain I say it again now. To be a tool used by Yahweh is not an honor. It's not an indication that that individual is special, good, smart, capable, qualified, quite the opposite. Well, as I'm reading the story of Gideon, I mean, but Gideon said and did. Come on. It's just, you just shake your head and say, come on, pal. What in the world is wrong with you? You know, you look at Dodie, he made more mistakes than he had hairs on his head. You look at Moshe. Huh. He was a stutterer.
Yeah.
Everybody that God has chosen over time to work with, even Yahshua, God takes him to heaven, and the first thing that he says when Yahweh is obviously disappointed that there's no one at the door that he has opened into his home, and Yahshua says, oh, I'm doomed. No, Hal, the creator God of the universe has just taken you as a three-dimensional construct and enabled you to come into his home in heaven. And he's talking directly to you. You, of all people, are not doomed.
You don't need to worry.
You don't need to worry about
this. Yeah, chill out.
Chill out. Everybody that God has chosen to work with is deeply flawed. Okay? So, you know, as we talk about this banner being lifted up, and it's clearly us.
Yeah.
Don't get a big head on your shoulder.
No.
Ain't nothing special about it.
Yeah, it's, God does not use impressive people. He just doesn't do it. Never has, never will. Okay? Now, the most impressive individual at the time of Dode was not Dode. Was Shaul.
No, Shaul.
Head and shoulders above everybody else.
No.
God didn't use him. You know, when even Midian is, Gideon is being approached, he says to God, why in the world would you come to me? I got nothing to offer.
Yeah.
Why would you come to me? It's a good start. But beyond that, you're listening to me, aren't you? Oh, yeah, well, come to think of it. I got nobody else who you wanted to listen to me. You know, and sometimes, and maybe even often, that's the only qualification. You're willing to listen. Yeah, people say, oh, I want to listen to God. No, they don't. They're not willing to invest the time to listen to what he has to say. And even as they begin the process, they don't like what he has to say, and so they give up and go do something else. The clear case is when Yahweh wants to engage you to convey his message, you better be willing to invest the time. I mean, he is not going to be shy about the time he uses. And so you better be ready. Without becoming weary. Devoid of a debilitating weakness and not prone to exhaustion, not requiring much rest, and seldom growing tired. This is written in the call participle, active masculine singular. Also, without stumbling or wavering, never being brought down or failing as a result of a contradiction, never backtracking, never losing control, and therefore steadfast. Now, that's one that I would have thought that there were two occasions. One was Donut Man, and the other was...
I remember that.
Yeah, something else. I forgot who it was. But,
yeah.
I was short with the two people who were promoting Christianity. And did two things. Oh, in fact, there was one that that I got some people in the Covenant didn't like at all. But Moody Jeff, I think, was the fellow's name, and I went beyond just exposing and criticizing all the way to mocking. And so you might say, well, without stumbling or wavering, yeah, that ain't you, pal, because you know you go to mocking. Well, we will in a future show tell the entire story of Eliyahu and the referendum between Yahweh and the Lord.
I love that story.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you, we can attest for
a lot of mocking going on there.
There's a lot of mocking, man.
Yeah.
That Eliyahu mocked the living bejesus out of him. He just absolutely just right in their face, and he didn't give them a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's wrong with your God? Is he out going to the bathroom?
Mm-hmm.
Not relieving himself? I mean, come on. So I have subsequently realized in reading Doe's words and Eliyahu's words and the like, mocking and overtly judging and criticizing is something that God does and wants us to do. Goes on to say, and with him in it, no one becomes drowsy or falls asleep. Now, we've written, 20,000 pages of material. But we're accused a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Never of being boring.
No, you know, every time you write another chapter and dig up all this stuff and we all go play in the sandbox and start looking up at everything, it's amazing. It just goes. I know there's same themes over and over because that's the way Yahweh teaches, but my gosh, there are nuggets all over the place.
Yeah, we are unearthing just a little gold mine of nuggets.
Yeah, it really is.
And it's like, you know, I could hardly sit still as I was translating the story of Eliyahu and this referendum between Yahweh and the Lord. And then when I had no idea. I mean, I thought that the day of Gideon would be just really boring. I had to translate two entire chapters of Shabbat. I didn't expect to find anything other than understand why the reference was there. Oh my! Every word was a treasure. Every word. Insights galore. Powerful insights. Additionally, the belt demonstrating that he is prepared and ready for action will not be loosened or undone. Around his waist and the connecting strap of his sandals shall not be torn or snapped. Now, this is the thing. If you look at anyone Yahweh chooses to work with, he does consume their time. Now, they still have lives. They were all married. They all had lives. They had kids. They, you know, they were active. But if you're willing to work with Yahweh and you're open to it, you know, you better be prepared to go. There isn't anyone who works with Yahweh who's timid. I will tell you, Gideon, he had a little hitch in his giddy up there for a while. But he finally got over it. As I said, he finally pulled up his big boy pants and was ready to roll. But that's the deal. It's, there are a couple things that I've recognized also. And I warn everyone all the time when they write me. And that is, don't share what you've come to know about Yahweh until you're prepared to do so. You need to be prepared. It takes time. You got to read. You got to learn. You got to translate. You have to verify. You have to think, and you have to go over sometimes the material four or five times before it literally becomes part of the fabric of your life, where it oozes out of you, where you go from knowing to retaining, and retaining to understanding, and then you're in a position to convey it. And so you need to gird yourself. You need to constantly be preparing. And you need to use it. If you're not using it, you can't retain it. Got to be ready for action. Moshe was ready for action. Dod was ready for action. Elia, ready for action. You got to be ready to go. And you got to be willing to be prepared. This idea that you know, you're going to wait on God and that somehow he's going to use you, nonsense. You got to be willing to do the work. And, you know, don't want to give the impression, I've said this a lot of times too. Working with Yahweh is work. It takes a lot of time. It's the most enjoyable thing you can do. Work is fun. Work is rewarding. Kirk, you're teaching less and studying more. You're working a lot on behalf of Yahweh. You have any regrets?
No, absolutely not. If it all got shut down, I think I'd just go sit down and be sick.
Yeah.
This is fun. I wish I had more energy. I mean, I can tell you that. I'm older, and I wish I had more energy and could do more. But I'm going to do something.
You know, I find myself most nights I can go to 9 o'clock before I start to wear down. And I typically start most mornings after I exercise at about 8:30 in the morning. So it's it's a 12-hour day.
Yeah.
And you know, I play golf, but I haven't played golf in 2 years.
Yeah.
I just live on a golf course.
You ought to get out and hit the ball around every once in a while.
Yeah, I haven't played in 2 years. You know, I have an airplane, but I don't go on vacation.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been on vacation in over a year. I may. You know, one of these days here, go on another
vacation. Every day is a vacation.
Yeah, but, you know, and you always got no issue with you doing that kind of stuff, but it's still, you invest the time in doing so, it's fun.
Oh, yeah.
It just is. Now, there is one frustrating part of it. Like, as I was, there's two chapters of Shaphat, Judges 6 and 7, to tell the story of Gideon, for example. And so, I decided I was going to tell the story differently. I wasn't just going to amplify the entire thing all the way through because I just wanted to carry the gist of the story. And so, you know, I went from the Hebrew and I tried to correct the New American Standard along the way. What I found out I was doing is even in a simple story, I was replacing 7 out of 10 words. You know, I would leave, he said, and I would leave...
Well, they did good to get that much right.
Yeah, I couldn't even leave things like with his hand because they would say with his power. You get frustrated because as I went through it, I had to change 80% of it from what was in the New American Standard that claims to be literal. And that part was frustrating. I mean, how in the world are people going to know the Word of God if it's so badly misrepresented? To show the way to the benefits of the relationship, his arrows, his shots, and his missiles are piercing. And all of his bows shoot effectively to show the way. Poetic language. That's the only way that, I mean, if... As Yashaya is trying to recount this, the language of the time, it means that when confronting things that are adversarial to Yahweh and adversarial to our life in the covenant, that to show the way of the relationship, what he has to say is piercing. It cuts right through the muck. They're compelling arguments. And the system that he uses to deliver those instructive shots, powerful shots, those potent shots, is effective. Now, the next part of this is it's personal, I think, and I realize that you have the opportunity to render this. A different way if you choose. but I just rendered it as the words spoke to me. Mm-hmm. It says, his swift flying transport. It's from Kook. A Kook is an enjoyable swallow, a sleek and fast bird. Now, there's people that want to translate it horses. I think it became horses because they were trying to figure out how in the world they could make the...
Horses don't have lungs.
The Vulgate, but... swift flying. If you look at the primary meaning of Kook, it's swift flying transport. So the swift flying transport's landing gear. This is perka, curved feet of a large bird or winged creature. Now, the curved feet of a large bird and winged creature, pretty descriptive of landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
It says Chasab is ingeniously crafted, is skillfully invented and planned, is machined, technically designed, devised and produced, is considered and imputed and thought to be straightforward and refined, small, narrow, akin to knives which spark like flint and as hard as on foes and hostile to opponents, from Chasar, vexing, testing, purging, refining, trending to shut people up, treating foes with enmity, frustrating them. So his swift-flying transport's landing gear is ingeniously crafted and straightforward and refined. And his propeller, the Gaul, serving as the round whirling device which makes his vehicle move, round turning implement for transportation akin to a paddle wheel, rotating and swirling, wind-producing structure. It's like a whirlwind. Blows a strong and straight column of wind in a circular fashion. Now, I'm going to tell you that that's not how you're going to read it in the King James. And this is clearly poetic language, but with a purpose. And while it could be describing his horse with sharp hooves, being skillfully invented with wheels turning like the wind, or his swift-flying transport replaced with ingeniously crafted landing gear, which is straightforward and refined, along with a propeller blowing a column of air behind it, neither actually represent the intent of these words. The man engaged with Yahweh, who assisted with the banner, moves around and travels quickly, and never loses his footing. The tools at his disposal were skillfully invented and technical in nature.
90.
And by deploying them, he stirs up a whirlwind of commotion, all designed to fulfill Yahweh's promise in the end. That's what the symbolic language means. And you can interpret it in terms of applying it in a real-world setting, however you choose. Now, this is, and this is why I enjoyed it, it's a fitting depiction of my TBM 850. It's a sleek and fast turboprop with a composite propeller and replete with very narrow retractable landing gear that have a knife edge on both sides of the round wheels. It may also be hinting at the fact that I've traveled by air to over 150 countries around the world. Without that exposure, without the lessons and perspective garnered by having flown around the world, I would not have been equipped and prepared to participate in this mission. It's also very limiting of the number of people that qualify. There are only 550,000 pilots in the United States. Only 150,000 of them hold an airline transport pilot certificate as I do. Less than a tenth of 1% of the population, with only half of them owning their own airplane. And a tenth of those flying a turboprop, you know, I'm a rare bird. So, once again, the purpose of this is to say that this individual engaged with Yahweh, who assisted with the banner, travels quickly and yet never loses his footing. The tools at his disposal were skillfully invented and technical in nature, and by deploying them, He stirs up a whirlwind of commotion, all designed to fulfill Yahweh's promise in the end. And we're not quite done. There's a lot more symbolism here in the next statement. The young lion is, as you know, Kirk, is the symbol of Yehuda, the family of Dod and Yosha, the home of Jerusalem, Moriah, Zion, and the covenant. And while I am an old lion, to be sure, my roar belies my age. And to the degree that my proclivities may matter, my prowess is in reconciling those willing to listen to Yah. Now, equipped with Yah's word, I've never lost a debate. It's not braggadocious, it's just a statement of fact. And no matter the threat, I've never been harmed. As for those whose message I challenge, those engaged in promoting the indefensible are always too far gone to be saved. They are challenged and tested not for their benefit, but instead on behalf of others not nearly so lost in the delusions of man. This is Yeshayah 5:29. His roaring approaches like a great old lion. And so his thunderous roar is like the prowess of a young reconciling lion. He grasps hold of the beast being pursued, and he survives unharmed. And no one can defend Guy individually, and then we collectively. Muhammad, Paul, Akiva.
Yeah, boy.
I mean, we destroyed them in debate. And so, his roaring, this is a loud and blaring guttural tone, approaches like a great old lion, a mighty and mature lion, serving as the symbol of Yehuda. And we are really serving as a symbol of Yehuda, to be related to Yah, to relate to Yah. And so his thunderous roar, his loud shouts and mighty cries, like the prowess of a young reconciling lion. The young lion, the word used to depict it is kefir. It's the basis of kapurim. It means to reconcile. He grasps hold of, a chaz. He seizes, taking hold of, the beast being pursued. The beast of Christianity. The beast of Imperial Rome. The beast of Paul. The beast of Muhammad. The beast of Akiba. Tearing up and destroying the prey. Yet he survives unharmed. He is spared any hardship. Delivered from danger, escaping without trouble. Psalm 91. And no one can defend or save it, speaking of the beast like Muhammad, Paul, and Akiva, Imperial Rome, the United States.
You know, you've destroyed those religions so completely that I went back and started reading their, because I have a pretty decent little library, and I went back and started reading their defense of the Christian apologist or the defenders of the faith or whatever they want to call themselves. And I broke it down about three things, and as I went over it, whether we ever share it or not, but when I went over it, I said, and I've heard all these things, you know, over the years as the defense of Christianity. And they're so lame, it's just unbelievable.
They are.
I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
I don't know how it's worse now.
Yeah, the worst that I ever encountered, Kirk, was the better part of a week I spent on one of the most cathartic moments of my life. You know, I started off based upon Dod Down Under, our good friend in the land of the Kiwi, who said that a number of radio hosts down there were conveying the idea that Paul said that the Torah could not save. And he asked me to see, was Paul mistranslated? What is it that would cause them to say that sort of thing? And so I tried to fix Paul. I tried to fix Galatians, which was his first book. Because he cited all these pastors were citing Galatians as Paul condemning the Torah. And I was doing my best to try to say, all right, he's not condemning the Torah, he's condemning the Talmud. And you know, I was running out of ammunition for that. And that and that maybe he's just misunderstood, and and we'll correct the record. But when I got to the covenant that was affirmed on Sinai, in slaves, because it was made with Hagar, necessitating a new covenant, I lost it. I mean, I just at that point, I decided, how in the world can anyone have read this and not realize that's a lie?
Mm-hmm.
And all the covenant on that was Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, that's the covenant in the Torah, and Hagar was expressly excluded from it, as was her son.
Yeah. He said absolutely not.
Yeah, Ishmael, absolutely not. And so Paul's allegory is an absolute lie.
Yeah.
And so as I was trying to figure out, how do Christians get around that? You know, I even wrote, you know, the guy that I was so close to and had written so many books with, Kent.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you justify this? Oh, you know, it's allegorical. Well, no, it's not. It's just a lie.
No.
And so I spent a week reading hundreds upon hundreds of Christians' apologies for it. And all they came up with is, you know,
Paul's right.
Paul replaced the Torah.
Yeah.
Paul is the author of the New Covenant, and the gospel of grace has indeed replaced the Torah. And I said, well, you know, first of all, you can't do that by lying about the Torah. You can't win an argument if the basis of it is a lie.
Yeah,
you can't start with a lie if that's the basis of your argument. And how in the hell do you justify a man contradicting God? Because God says exactly the opposite. And how do you claim that this man was inspired by God to contradict God? If that were the case, then neither the man nor God could be trusted.
Yeah,
it was so obvious.
Category.
But I did the same thing, Kirk, that you did. I went to read their apologies, and they were as bad as Paul's. Oh gosh!
Yeah,
just turned your stomach.
I don't know how you can read that much drivel and come away. I wish I had done it when I was a Christian. I mean, I read them, but I read them with no filter. You know,
yeah, what happened to me is that you know, I got sucked into it, and I got deeper and deeper, an ordained ruling elder and Bible study teacher, and I gave prayers at the large groups, large commencement addresses with in the National Senate, and taught evangelism, led evangelism, and I got deeper and deeper into it, and began to be concerned about the conflicts. And then as I got in business and I was pulled, you know, away to focus on supporting my family and building businesses, those conflicts became serious concerns. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me on the upright pole? Well, that's... How can, you know, if he's supposed to be God, how can God leave him? I was just, the Trinity I knew was Babylonian. I knew that Christmas and Easter were pagan concepts. You know, I knew that the Torah spoke about the seventh day, the Shabbat, and Christians were worshiping on Sunday. I realized that a God who wants to be worshipped isn't worth knowing. There were so many just unanswerable questions. I knew his name couldn't be Jesus. The last name couldn't be Christ. And that the Trinity was Babylonian. That there was no evidence whatsoever that with billions of people praying about everything under the sun, that God had ever answered a single one of them.
Yeah. Well, the football thing is really just laughable. I mean, like about and my shout out to Sam Trapper, your touchdown. I mean, come on, people.
Oh yeah, every you know, I'm watching these baseball games, and everybody that gets a hit or shuts up, strikes somebody out, you know, does points to the sky. just like the football, it's almost unwatchable because of of this giving God credit for their strikeout, home run, or touchdown. It's just, I mean, it's revolting. You know, such a God that would get involved in siding with one person or another is not worth knowing. And so I was also fighting with how in the world could Paul say one thing and everything, mm-hmm. you know, and Yosha completely contradict it. So I had a period where I was an agnostic. I went from devout Christian to agnostic. And so it wasn't so hard for me to, once I was seriously translating what he had to say,
mm-hmm.
To embrace the truth. I'd already given up on the lie.
Yeah. And you had to be, I don't think you can come to Yahweh or him approach you if you don't walk away to some degree. You've got to be out of Babylon, at least your brain, whether it's, and which is just like the story of Abraham. I mean, he was out of town.
Yeah.
He wasn't in Ur anymore.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And Yahweh didn't say very much to him.
He was two-thirds of the way home.
Yeah.
By the time
he was growing, right?
Right.
When he,
Aaron. Two-thirds of the way home. Yeah, from her.
So, you know, and I know Terry and I, you know, her quicker than me walked away from Christianity and decided we'd find it in all the books we had. It's got to be in there somewhere. And then she listened to you and so on and on.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. I don't think it goes to somebody who's deep into religion or politics or the military and introduces himself while you're deep into it.
No, I don't think you can. I don't think you'll hear him.
No.
You won't have an open mind.
I don't think he's willing to do it. He's not willing to subject himself to that. So it's not. Yeah. He's not willing to do it, and the person is not going to be receptive. So why bother?
Yeah.
And one of the things that is so stunning is when, you know, out of a nation probably of 3 or 4 million at the time, and Yahweh says that 22,000 is way too many. This is just too many people. Can't deal with this many people. Send them away. Boy, that ever destroys this myth that God wants to save everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't want to work with a small percentage of them and kept on calling them until he got the 300. But even with the 300, he only talked to one of them.
Yeah.
You know, it was.
It's pretty obvious when
you
look at it.
You know, follow me. Do what I do.
Observe the Torah.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to miss that.
I don't think Gideon was the sharpest tool in the shed either.
No.
I did not walk away with a favorable impression of Gideon. I think Gideon's entire claim to fame in this particular story is that he was willing to listen up to a point, and he was willing to act so long as God constantly proved himself. And I was the proof is a really fascinating story of what all the symbolism means in the proof.
Mm-hmm.
I have never once even. I did when I was a Christian, but since I've come to know Yahweh, I have never once even thought for a second about asking God to prove himself.
Show me a sign, sort of thing?
Yeah, show me a sign.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
I don't need a sign. I've got his word.
It's
obvious.
I've got his word. Yes, I know.
I mean, I got 1,000 signs right here.
That's correct. They're every word is a sign. He proves his existence and that he is reliable a million times over. So why would you want to sign? It's insulting to say.
Yeah, this is irrefutable. I don't care who you are. Go ahead. Take a shot.
Yeah, take a shot. Go ahead. And Gideon, of course, asked for a sign, and then he asked for another sign. And even then, when the enemy was so numerous in the valley and Gideon got cold feet, he had Gideon go down and he says, I want you to go down there to the enemy and listen to what they have to say. And so God staged a conversation down there about how a loaf of barley, unleavened barley cake, rolled down the hill, and then the guy interpreted the dream and said, "Well, this is Gideon, a man of Yahweh, and he is going to destroy our encampment, and God's given us into his hand." And you say, "Okay, dude, you've been set up, man."
Yeah, I guess.
You've been set up. God is saying, time for you to put your big boy pants on.
Let's go, boy.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, and then Gideon originally comes back, and you read every English translation. Before he left the enemy camp, he got down on his knees and worshipped. Now, of course,
no.
Just before the test was of who's not going to go with him is anybody on their knees. And he's still in the enemy camp. He ain't going to be worshiping. And it's the word that means that he responded verbally. He made a declaration. Well, he immediately goes and leaves the camp. It says he arrives back at the top of the hill where the Israelites are, the 300 Israelites. And he immediately makes an announcement. He says, Yahweh has confirmed that he's going to do what he promised. And so let's get going. It's time to stand up and go. And you know, here's what we're going to do. Take our shofars, and we're going to take our tiki torches.
And destroy 50,000. Why not?
Yeah. It doesn't even say how many there were. Too many to count. And then... we're going to blow our horns and shatter our tiki torches, and they're all going to flee. And then Yahweh's going to deal with them. Yeah, so it's quite the story. Fun stuff. All right, well, we have actually finished Yeshayah 5. That is the end of the chapter. So even on this program now, we'll be able to go back to, I think it's 10, where we are talking about the history of translations. Hopefully Scott will be back in. Scott had a marvelous time down there in Austin.
Pretty good.
Yeah, really a marvelous time. The amazing thing, too, is that Alex Jones, who was really, really nice to him and gave him an enormous amount of time, actually asked Scott, you know, what would you recommend? Based on what you know so far, what am I doing wrong? What would you recommend I do going forward? And Scott laid it on. He just said everything that you'd want him to say. And Alex Jones said, yeah, you're right. That's what I needed to hear. And that's why I want you here. I don't want you to ever be afraid to tell me what you really think. That's what I need to hear.
Well,
so it was a really, really good meeting. So anyway, we'll have Scott in Minnesota for another few months, and I don't know how we'll work from there. But we know that Alex Jones has a bigger, better setup than does GCN, and so that observation show doesn't affect this show, but the observation show. That's how it's how it's manifest, and so we should be able to continue it there. But if we don't, we can double up on Yada Radio on VTR. You know, I pay for their top fee, so that we can use it whenever we want to use it. So we can just have a second one of those, and we'll figure out a way to get.
Put it all together.
Published on the various sites, on the YouTube and on the various websites. All right. Well, that's a wrap for this evening. Timing worked out well for us.
Perfectly.
Yeah. And you know, I hope that people aren't too blown away by the thought that here's Yeshayah, and he may have been talking about us. And if he's not talking about us, that's just fine. But I sure as heck like to know what he's talking about.
He's talking about us.
Yeah, I think he's talking about us.
That's okay.
That's okay. Yeah.
All right. right, my friends, are we going to call it a night? And then,
yeah, and by the way, you know, for all we have been doing and the profound insights that we've uncovered and the tens of thousands of pages we have translated and commented on, so that's pretty significant, particularly in a world where there have gone centuries without a single person that Yahweh could communicate through. You would expect that there would be, you know, some reference, some notice.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess, this isn't the only one.
It's just not an insignificant event. It certainly isn't for my life.
No.
I mean, just and the handful of people that I get a chance to talk to and know personally, this is like monumental. And it's against all odds. You're against everything.
Right.
We're against the entire world. So this is, I don't know how else I could say how significant it is.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry it's so few.
Yeah, but because it's so clear,
that's the way it is.
Wonderful, so right, so obvious.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the fact that most people are indoctrinated by religion or improperly educated and they've lost their ability to exercise good judgment, everyone that heard this would just instantly embrace Yahweh and his covenant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that they have not just touched it.
Only proves what Yahweh
says. Fallen condition of man. Yeah, the fallen condition of man.
Mm-hmm.
Time of darkness. All right, fellas. Stay safe. Stay content. We'll do this again next week.
Yeah,
was that your dog? Is that your dog barking in the background, or was that James yours?
It's got to be James's.
Okay.
Mine's downstairs, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good night.
All right, guys. Enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah.
Take care.
By the way, you know, I am a Dodger fan, one of the few teams I actually follow. And they're in the World Series, you know?
They won. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You don't follow baseball much?
No, I used to follow. I used to follow the Dodgers back when they were, and Kurt Gibson and all those guys, and went to San Diego, and also I kind of lost for a while. I've kind of been disinterested, but it takes so long for them to come back, because it takes so many people they have to recruit or bring up through their farm program.
Oh, I know. Yeah, no, 1988, the last time that they won
a long
series,
time.
Or even in a World long Series. Time. Yeah, I was over in China at the time. I remember that
I remember
the entire series. I was in China.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Right after both of our first two sons were born, and I'm over in China, of all places. Well, I'll be in China this time.
In fact, that's the last ball game I actually physically went to see was the Dodgers over those years. You know, we had some people that had tickets all the time, and they would invite us. So,
I've been to 100 Dodger games. So
yeah,
I've seen my share. Both of my sons are Dodger fans.
Oh.
So yeah, it's fun. And my university gets to play Notre Dame this weekend.
Yeah, well, I'm so pulling for them.
Yeah, I am too.
Every time somebody plays Notre Dame, I pull for them.
Yeah, I know. I
still have the faith of Alabama destroying them.
USC and who's ever playing Notre Dame.
I know y'all would not get involved, but it's great fun to watch.
I know. It's still fun to watch.
I'm pulling for them, though.
Yeah, just so opposed to Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Hey, what's interesting is that the last time they actually did a survey of the number of Catholics on USC's team versus Notre Dame's team, there were twice as many Catholics on USC's team as Notre Dame's.
That doesn't surprise me. The Catholic schools, I guess, it's because they can recruit basically in high school because they can take them for whatever reason. They can go to religious school,
right.
So you're not zoned. You have to stay in your geographic area, so
second only to Boston that Cincinnati, where I'm living, has the highest percentage of Roman Catholics.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And we're inundated with Muslims, just inundated with them. But that's because of Procter & Gamble being here and worldwide, and they have so many Muslims in their headquarters.
Really?
We have just... a mile away, the Islamic Center in Ohio. Oh, it's huge mosque right on the freeway. It makes me want to puke every time I drive by it.
Yeah.
I had 2 doors away from a Muslim family.
Yeah, well, we have one in our neighborhood, and yeah.
And, you know, the thing is just so irritating to me is that Mohammed was a terrorist. He was a pedophile. He was a rapist. He was a mass murderer. The Quran is the worst book ever written. And Muslims perpetrate 99.9% of the world's terrorist acts.
Yeah.
And you say, and you're in the world, could you be promoting that religion? In a free country where you have the opportunity to walk away from it without being killed.
It's staggering, isn't it?
Staggering.
I mean, that's one little list, and people will go, and nobody seems to know it. Because I mentioned that, and they say, if it comes up, I tell them, this is Muhammad, according to Muhammad, according to the Quran. Read yourself. I can give it to you in English if you like. And they just go.
75 terrorist rapes in 10 years.
Yeah. Pedophile, mass murderer, slave trader.
Yeah.
What do you want?
Right.
Rapist.
Wow. Right.
Why are you not angry? Can stand women.
Who admitted twice that he was demon possessed.
Yeah.
Why would you respect something like that? Why would you tolerate it? What? You know, just sick. All right, my friend, you have a good evening. Best to Jerry.
Yes, indeed. Good evening.
Thank you.